Chapter 9. The Saracen's Head. 1.
It was the worst dream I've had yet, said Jane next morning. She was seated in the blue room with the director and Grace Ironwood.
Yes, said the director, yours is perhaps the hardest post, until the real struggle begins.
I dreamed I was in a dark room, said Jane, with queer smells in it and a sort of low humming noise. Then the light came on, but not very much light, and for a long time I didn't realize what I was looking at. And when I made it out, I should have waked up if I hadn't made a great effort not to, I thought I saw a face floating in front of me. A face, not a head, if you understand what I mean. That is, there was a beard and nose and eyes. At least you couldn't see the eyes because it had colored glasses on, but there didn't seem to be anything above the eyes. Not at first. But as I got used to the light, I got a horrible shock. I thought the face was a mask tied onto a kind of balloon thing, but it wasn't exactly. Perhaps it looked a bit like a man wearing a sort of turban, though I'm telling this dreadfully badly. What it really was a head, the rest of a head, which had had the top part of the skull taken off, and then, as if something inside had boiled over. A great big mass which bulged out from inside what was left of the skull. Wrapped in some kind of composition stuff, but very thin stuff. You could see it twitch. Even in my fright I remember thinking, oh, kill it, put it out of its pain. But only for a second, because I thought the thing was real, really. It was green-looking, and the mouth was wide open and quite dry. You realize I was a long time looking at it before anything else happened, and soon I saw that it wasn't exactly floating. It was fixed up on some kind of bracket or shelf or pedestal, I don't know quite what, and there were things hanging from it, from the neck, I mean. Yes, it had a neck and a sort of collar thing round it, but nothing below the collar, no shoulders or body, only these hanging things. In the dream I thought it was some kind of new man that had only head and entrails. I thought all those tubes were its insides. But presently, I don't quite know how, I saw that they were artificial. Little rubber tubes and bulbs and little metal things, too. I couldn't understand them. All the tubes went into the wall. Then at last something happened. "You're all right, Jane, are you?" said Miss Ironwood.
"Oh, yes," said Jane, "as far as that goes. Only one somehow doesn't want to tell it. Well, quite suddenly, like when an engine is started, there came a puff of air out of its mouth, with a hard, dry, rasping sound. And then there came another. And it settled down into a sort of rhythm. Huff, huff, huff. Like an imitation of breathing. Then came a most horrible thing. The mouth began to dribble. Oh, I know it sounds silly, but in a way I felt sorry for it, because it had no hands and couldn't wipe its mouth. It seems a small thing compared with all the rest, but that is how I felt. Then it began working its mouth about and even licking its lips. It was like someone getting a machine into working order. To see it doing that, just as if it was alive, and at the same time dribbling over the beard which was all stiff and dead-looking. Then three people came into the room, all dressed up in white with masks on, walking as carefully as cats on the top of a wall. One was a great fat man, and another was lanky and bony. The third... Here Jane paused involuntarily. The third... I think it was Mark. I mean my husband.
You are uncertain? Said the director.
No, said Jane. It was Mark. I knew his walk, and I knew the shoes he was wearing, and his voice. It was Mark.
I am sorry, said the director.
And then, said Jane, all three of them came round and stood in front of the head. They bowed to it. You couldn't tell if it was looking at them because of its dark glasses. It kept on with that rhythmical huffing noise. Then it spoke.
"In English?" said Grace Ironwood.
"No, in French."
"What did it say?"
"Well, my French wasn't quite good enough to follow it. It spoke in a queer way. It starts like a man who's out of breath, with no proper expression. And, of course, it couldn't turn itself this way or that, as a real person does."
The director spoke again. "Did you understand any of what was said?"
"Well, not very much." The fat man seemed to be introducing Mark to it. It said something to him. Then Mark tried to answer. I could follow him all right. His French isn't much better than mine.
What did he say?
He said something about doing it in a few days, if it was possible.
Was that all?
Oh, very nearly. You see, Mark couldn't stand it. I knew he wouldn't be able to. I remember, idiotically, in the dream I wanted to tell him. I saw that he was going to fall. I think I tried to shout out to the other two, "He's going to fall." But of course I couldn't. He was sick, too. Then they got him out of the room.
All three were silent for a few seconds.
"Was that all?" said Miss Ironwood. "Yes," said Jane. "That's all I remember. I think I woke up then."
The director took a deep breath. "Well," he said, glancing at Miss Ironwood, "it becomes plainer and plainer. We must hold a council at once. Is everyone here?"
"No. Dr. Dimble has had to go into Edgestowe, into college, to take pupils. He won't be back till evening."
"Then we must hold the council this evening. Make all arrangements." He paused for a moment and then turned to Jane. "I am afraid this is very bad for you, my dear," he said, "and worse for him."
"You mean for Mark, sir?"
The director nodded.
"Yes.
Don't think hardly of him. He is suffering. If we are defeated, we shall all go down with him. If we win, we will rescue him. He cannot be far gone yet." He paused, smiled, and added, "We are quite used to trouble about husbands here, you know. Poor Ivy's is in jail."
"In jail?"
"Oh, yes. For ordinary theft. But quite a good fellow. He'll be all right again." Though Jane felt horror, even to the point of nausea, at the sight in her dream of Mark's real surroundings and associates, it had been horror that carried a certain grandeur and mystery with it. The sudden equation between his predicament and that of a common convict whipped the blood to her cheeks. She said nothing.
"One other thing," continued the director. "You will not misunderstand it if I exclude you from our council tonight?"
"Of course not, sir," said Jane,
in fact misunderstanding it very much.
"You see," he said, "McPhee takes the line that if you hear things talked of, you will carry ideas of them into your sleep, and that will destroy the evidential value of your dreams. And it's not very easy to refute him. He is our skeptic, a very important office."
"I quite understand," said Jane.
"That applies, of course," said the director, "only to things we don't know yet. You mustn't hear our guesses. You mustn't be there when we're puzzling over the evidence. But we have no secrets from you about the earlier history of our family. In fact, McPhee himself will insist on being the one who tells you all that. He'd be afraid Grace's account, or mine, wouldn't be objective enough."
"I see."
"I want you to like him, if you can. He's one of my oldest friends, and he'll be about our best man if we're going to be defeated. You couldn't have a better man at your side in a losing battle. What he'll do if we win, I can't imagine."
2.
Mark woke next morning to the consciousness that his head ached all over, but specially at the back. He remembered that he had fallen. That was how he had hurt his head, fallen in that other room with Philostrato and Strake. And then, as one of the poets says, he discovered in his mind an inflammation swollen and deformed his memory.
Oh, but impossible! Not to be accepted for a moment. It had been a nightmare. It must be shoved away. It would vanish away now that he was fully awake. It was an absurdity. Once, in delirium, he had seen the front part of a horse, by itself, with no body or hind legs, running across a lawn. Had felt it ridiculous at the very moment of seeing it, but not the less horrible for that. This was an absurdity of the same sort. A head without any body underneath. A head that could speak when they turned on the air and the artificial saliva with taps in the next room. His own head began to throb so hard that he had to stop thinking. But he knew it was true, and he could not, as they say, take it. He was very ashamed of this, for he wished to be considered one of the tough ones. But the truth is that his toughness was only of the will, not of the nerves, and the virtues he had almost succeeded in banishing from his mind still lived, if only negatively and as weaknesses, in his body. He approved of vivisection, but had never worked in a dissecting room. He recommended that certain classes of people should be gradually eliminated, but he had never been there when a small shopkeeper went to the workhouse, or a starved old woman of the governess type came to the very last day and hour and minute in the cold attic. He knew nothing about the last half cup of cocoa drunk slowly 10 days before. Meantime, he must get up. He must do something about Jane. Apparently he would have to bring her to Belbury. His mind had made this decision for him at some moment he did not remember.
He must get her to save his life. All his anxieties about being in the inner ring or getting a job had shrunk into insignificance. It was a question of life or death. They would kill him if he annoyed them, perhaps behead him. Oh, God, if only they would really kill that monstrous little lump of torture, that lump with a face which they kept there talking on its steel bracket. All the minor fears at Belbury, for he knew now that all except the leaders were always afraid, were only emanations from that central fear. He must get Jane. He wasn't fighting against that now. It must be remembered that in Mark's mind hardly one rag of noble thought, either Christian or pagan, had a secure lodging. His education had been neither scientific nor classical, merely modern. The severities both of abstraction and of high human tradition had passed him by. And he had neither pleasant shrewdness nor aristocratic honour to help him. He was a man of straw, a glib examinee in subjects that require no exact knowledge. He had always done well on essays and general papers, and the first hint of a real threat to his bodily life knocked him sprawling. And his head ached so terribly, and he felt so sick. Luckily, he now kept a bottle of whiskey in his room. A stiff one enabled him to shave and dress. He was late for breakfast, but that made little difference, for he could not eat. He drank several cups of black coffee and then went into the writing room. Here he sat for a long time drawing things on the blotting paper. This letter to Jane proved almost impossible now that it came to the point. And why did they want Jane? Formless fears stirred in his mind. And Jane, of all people? Would they take her to the head? For almost the first time in his life, a gleam of something like disinterested love came into his mind. He wished he had never married her, never dragged her into this whole outfit of horrors which was, apparently, to be his life. "Hello, Studdock," said a voice. "Writing to little wifey, then?" "Damn," said Mark, "you've made me drop my pen." "Well, then pick it up, sonny," said Miss Hardcastle, seating herself on the table. Mark did so, and then sat still without looking up at her. Not since he had been bullied at school had he known what it was to hate and dread anyone with every nerve of his body, as he now hated and dreaded this woman. "I've got bad news for you, sonny," she said presently. His heart gave a jump. "Take it like a man, Studdock," said the fairy. "What is it?" She did not answer quite at once, and he knew she was studying him, watching how the instrument responded to her playing. "I'm worried about little wifey, and that's a fact," she said at last. "What do you mean?" said Mark sharply, this time looking up. The cheroot between her teeth was still unlit, but she had got as far as taking out her matches. "I looked her up," said Miss Hardcastle. "All on your account, too. I thought Edgestow wasn't too healthy a place for her to be at present." "What's wrong with her?" shouted Mark. "Shh," said Miss Hardcastle. "You don't want everyone to hear. Can't you tell me what's wrong?" She waited for a few seconds before replying. "How much do you know about her family, Studdock?" "Well, lots. What's that got to do with it?" "Nothing queer on either side?" "What the devil do you mean?" "Don't be rude, honey. I'm doing all I can for you. It's only, well, I thought she was behaving pretty oddly when I saw her." Mark well remembered the conversation with his wife on the morning he left for Belbury. A new stab of fear pierced him. Might not this detestable woman be speaking the truth? "What did she say?" he asked. "If there is anything wrong with her in that way," said the fairy, "take my advice, Studdock, and have her over here at once. She'll be properly looked after here. You haven't yet told me what she said or did. I wouldn't like to have anyone belonging to me popped into Edgestow Asylum, especially now that we're getting our emergency powers. They'll be using the ordinary patients experimentally, you know. Whereas if you'll just sign this form, I'll run over after lunch and have her here this evening." Mark threw his pen on the desk. "I shall do nothing of the sort, especially as you haven't given me the slightest notion what's wrong with her." "I've been trying to tell you, but you don't let me. She kept on talking about someone who'd broken into your flat, or else met her at the station, one couldn't make out which, and burned her with cigars. Then, most unfortunately, she noticed my cheroot, and, if you please, she identified me with this imaginary persecutor. Of course, after that, I could do no good." "I must go home at once," said Mark, getting up. "Hey, whoa, you can't do that," said the fairy, also rising. "Can't go home?
"'I've bloody well got to, if all this is true.' "'Oh, don't be a fool, Lovey,' said Miss Hardcastle. "'Honest, I know what I'm talking about. "'You're in a damn dangerous position already. "'You'll about do yourself in if you're absent without leave now. "'Send me, sign the form. "'That's the sensible way to do it. "'But a moment ago you said she couldn't stand you at any price. "'Oh, that wouldn't make any odds. "'Of course it would be easier if she hadn't taken a dislike to me. "'I say, Studdock, you don't think little wifey could be jealous, do you?' "'Jealous? Of you?' said Mark, with uncontrollable disgust. "'Where are you off to?' said the fairy sharply. "'To see the D.D. and then home. Stop! "'You won't do that unless you mean to make me your enemy for life. "'And let me tell you, you can't afford many more enemies.' "'Oh, go to the devil!' said Mark. "'Come back, Studdock!' shouted the fairy. "'Wait! Don't be a bloody fool!' "'But Mark was already in the hall.' For the moment everything seemed to have become clear. He would look in on Wither, not to ask for leave, but simply to announce that he had to go home at once because his wife was dangerously ill. He would be out of the room before Wither could reply, and then off. The further future was vague, but that did not seem to matter. He put on his hat and coat, ran upstairs and knocked at the door of the deputy director's office. There was no answer. Then Mark noticed that the door was not quite shut. He ventured to push it open a little further and saw the deputy director sitting inside with his back to the door. "'Excuse me, sir,' said Mark. "'Might I speak to you for a few minutes?' There was no answer. "'Excuse me, sir,' said Mark in a louder voice, but the figure neither spoke nor moved. With some hesitation, Mark went into the room and walked around to the other side of the desk. But when he turned to look at Wither, he caught his breath, for he thought he was looking into the face of a corpse. A moment later, he recognized his mistake. In the stillness of the room, he could hear the man breathing. He was not even asleep, for his eyes were open. He was not unconscious, for his eyes rested momentarily on Mark and then looked away. "'I beg your pardon, sir,' began Mark, and then stopped. The deputy director was not listening. He was so far from listening that Mark felt an insane doubt whether he was there at all. Whether the soul of the deputy director were not floating far away, spreading and dissipating itself like a gas through formless and lightless worlds, wastelands and lumber rooms of the universe. What looked out of those pale, watery eyes was, in a sense, infinity, the shapeless and the interminable. The room was still and cold. There was no clock and the fire had gone out. It was impossible to speak to a face like that. Yet it seemed impossible also to get out of the room, for the man had seen him. Mark was afraid. It was so unlike any experience he had ever had before. When at last Mr. Wither spoke, his eyes were not fixed on Mark, but on some remote point beyond him, beyond the window, perhaps in the sky. "'I know who it is,' said Wither. "'Your name is Studdock. What do you mean by coming here? You had better have stayed outside. Go away.' It was then that Mark's nerve suddenly broke. All the slowly mounting fears of the last few days ran together in one fixed determination, and a few seconds later he was going downstairs three steps at a time. Then he was crossing the hall, then he was out and walking down the drive. Once again his immediate course seemed quite plain to him. Opposite the entrance was a thick belt of trees pierced by a field path. The path would bring him in half an hour to Courthampton, and there he could get a country bus to Edgestow. About the future he did not think at all. Only two things mattered. Firstly, to get out of that house, and secondly, to get back to Jane. He was devoured with a longing for Jane which was physical without being at all sensual. As if comfort and fortitude would flow from her body, as if her very skin would clean away all the filth that seemed to hang about him. The idea that she might be really mad had somehow dropped out of his mind. And he was still young enough to be incredulous of misery. He could not quite rid himself of the belief that if only he made a dash for it, the net must somehow break, the sky must clear, and it would all end up with Jane and Mark having tea together as if none of all this had happened. He was out of the grounds now. He was crossing the road. He had entered a belt of trees. He stopped suddenly. Something impossible was happening. There was a figure before him on the path, a tall, very tall, slightly stooping figure, sauntering and humming a little dreary tune. The deputy director himself. And in one moment, all that brittle hardihood was gone from Mark's mood. He turned back. He stood in the road. This seemed to him the worst pain that he ever felt. Then, tired,
so tired that he felt the weak tears filling his eyes, he walked very slowly back into Belbury. 3. Mr. McPhee had a little room on the ground floor at the manor which he called his office, and to which no woman was ever admitted except under his own conduct. And in this tidy but dusty apartment he sat with Jane Studdock shortly before dinner that evening, having invited her there to give her what he called a brief, objective outline of the situation.
"I should premise at the outset, Mrs. Studdock," he said, "that I have known the director for a great many years, and that for most of his life he was a philologist. I'm not just satisfied myself that philology can be regarded as an exact science, but I mention the fact as a testimony to his general intellectual capacity. And not to forejudge any issue, I will not say, as I would in ordinary conversation, that he has always been a man of what you might call an imaginative turn. His original name was Ransom."
"Not Ransom's Dialect and Semantics," said Jane.
"Aye, that's the man," said McPhee. "Well, about 6 years ago, I have all the dates in a wee book there, but it doesn't concern us at the moment, came his first disappearance. He was clean gone, not a trace of him, for about 9 months. I thought he'd most likely been drowned bathing or something of the kind. And then one day what does he do but turn up again in his rooms at Cambridge and go down sick and into hospital for 3 months more. And he wouldn't say where he'd been except privately to a few friends."
"Well?" said Jane eagerly.
"He said," answered McPhee, producing his snuff-box and laying great emphasis on the word said. "He said he'd been to the planet Mars."
"You mean he said this while he was ill?"
"No, no, he says so still. Make what you can of it. That's his story."
"I believe it," said Jane.
McPhee selected a pinch of snuff with as much care as if those particular grains had differed from all the others in his box, and spoke before applying them to his nostrils.
"I'm giving you the facts," he said. "He told us he'd been to Mars, kidnapped by Professor Weston and Mr. Devine, Lord Featherstone as he now is. And by his own account he'd escaped from them, on Mars, you'll understand, and been wandering about there alone for a bit. Alone."
"Oh, it's uninhabited, I suppose."
"We have no evidence on that point except his own story. You are doubtless aware, Mrs. Studdock, that a man in complete solitude, even on this earth, an explorer, for example, gets into very remarkable states of consciousness. I'm told a man might forget his own identity."
"You mean he might have imagined things on Mars that weren't there?"
"I'm making no comments," said McPhee. "I'm merely recording. By his own accounts, there are all kinds of creatures walking about there. That's maybe why he has turned his house into a sort of menagerie, but no matter for that. He also says he met one kind of creature there which specially concerns us at this moment. He called them Eldils."
"A kind of animal, do you mean?"
"Did ever you try to define the word animal, Mrs. Studdock?"
"Well, not that I remember. I meant, were these things,
well, intelligent? Could they talk?"
"Aye,
they could talk. They were intelligent, for by, which is not always the same thing."
"In fact, these were the Martians?"
"Well, that's just what they weren't, according to his account. They were on Mars, but they didn't rightly belong there. He says they are creatures that live in empty space."
"But there's no air."
"I'm telling you his story. He says they don't breathe. He said also that they don't reproduce their species and don't die. But you'll observe that even if we assume the rest of his story to be correct, this last statement could not rest on observation."
"What on earth are they like?"
"I'm telling you how he described them."
"I mean, what do they look like?"
"I'm not just exactly prepared to answer that question," said McPhee.
"Are they perfectly huge?" said Jane, almost involuntarily.
McPhee blew his nose and continued.
"The point, Mrs. Studdock," he said, "is this. Dr. Ransom claims that he has received continual visits from these creatures since he returned to Earth. So much for his first disappearance. Then came the second. He was away for more than a year, and that time he said he'd been in the planet Venus, taken there by these Eldils."
"Venus is inhabited by them too?"
"You'll forgive me observing that this remark shows you have not grasped what I'm telling you. These creatures are not planetary creatures at all. Supposing them to exist, you are to conceive them floating about the depth of space, though they may alight on a planet here and there, like a bird alighting on a tree, you understand. that some of them, he says, are more or less permanently attached to particular planets, but they're not native there. They're just a clean, different kind of thing.
There were a few seconds of silence, and then Jane asked, "They are, I gather, more or less friendly."
"That is certainly the director's idea about them, with one important exception."
"What's that?"
"The Eldils that have for many centuries concentrated on our own planet. We seem to have had no luck at all in choosing our particular complement of parasites. And that, Mrs. Studdock, brings me to the point."
Jane waited. It was extraordinary how McPhee's manner almost neutralized the strangeness of what he was telling her.
"The long and short of it is," said he, "that this house is dominated either by the creatures I'm talking about or by a sheer delusion. It is by advices he thinks he has received from Eldils that the director has discovered the conspiracy against the human race. And what's more, it's on instructions from Eldils that he's conducting the campaign, if you can call it conducting. It may have occurred to you to wonder, Mrs. Studdock, how any man in his senses thinks we're going to defeat a powerful conspiracy by sitting here growing winter vegetables and training performing bears. It is a question I have propounded on more than one occasion. The answer is always the same. We're waiting for orders."
"From the Eldils?"
"It was they he meant when he spoke of his masters?"
"I doubt it would be, though he doesn't use that word in speaking to me."
"But, Mr. McPhee, I don't understand. I thought you said the ones on our planet were hostile."
"That's a very good question," said McPhee. "But it's not our own ones that the director claims to be in communication with. It's his friends from outer space. Our own crew, the terrestrial Eldils, are at the back of the whole conspiracy. You are to imagine us, Mrs. Studdock, living on a world where the criminal classes of the Eldils have established their headquarters. And what's happening now, if the director's views are correct, is that their own respectable kith and kin are visiting this planet to red the place up."
"You mean that the other Eldils out of space actually come here, to this house?"
"That is what the director thinks."
"But you must know whether it's true or not."
"How?"
"Well, have you seen them?"
"That's not a question to be answered, aye or no. I've seen a good many things in my time that weren't there, or weren't what they were letting on to be. Rainbows and reflections and sunsets, not to mention dreams. And there's heterosuggestion, too. I will not deny that I have observed a class of phenomena in this house that I have not yet fully accounted for. But they never occurred at a moment when I had a notebook handy or any facilities for verification."
"Isn't seeing believing?"
"Oh, it may be, for children or beasts," said McPhee.
"But not for sensible people, you mean?"
"My uncle, Dr. Duncanson," said McPhee, "whose name may be familiar to you, he was moderator of the General Assembly over the water in Scotland, used to say, 'Show me in the Word of God,' and then he'd slap the big Bible on the table. It was a way he had of shutting people up that came to him blathering about religious experiences, and granting his premises, he was quite right. I don't hold his views, Mrs. Studdock, you understand, but I work on the same principles. If anything wants Andrew McPhee to believe in its existence, I'll be obliged if it will present itself in full daylight with a sufficient number of witnesses present, and not get shy if you hold up a camera or a thermometer."
McPhee regarded his snuffbox meditatively.
"You have seen something, then?"
"Aye. But we must keep an open mind. It might be a hallucination. It might be a conjuring trick."
"By the director?" asked Jane angrily. Mr. McPhee once more had recourse to his snuffbox. "Do you really expect me," said Jane, "to believe that the director is that sort of man, a charlatan?"
"I wish, ma'am," said McPhee, "you could see your way to consider the matter without constantly using such terms as believe. Obviously, conjuring is one of the hypotheses that any impartial investigator must take into account. The fact that it is a hypothesis specially uncongenial to the emotions of this investigator or that is neither here nor there. Unless maybe it is an extra ground for emphasizing the hypothesis in question, just because there is a strong psychological danger of neglecting it."
"Well, there's such a thing as loyalty," said Jane.
McPhee, who had been carefully shutting up the snuffbox, suddenly looked up with 100 Covenanters in his eyes. "There is, ma'am," he said. "As you get older, you will learn that it is a virtue too important to be lavished on individual personalities."
At that moment there was a knock at the door.
"Come in," said McPhee, and Camilla entered.
"Have you finished with Jane, Mr. McPhee?" she said. "She promised to come out for a breath of air with me before dinner."
"'Och, breath of air, your grandmother!' said McPhee, with a gesture of despair. "'Very well, ladies, very well. Away out to the garden. I doubt they're doing something more to the purpose on the enemy's side. They'll have all this country under their hands before we move at this rate.'
"'I wish you'd read the poem I'm reading,' said Camilla, "'for it says in one line just what I feel about this waiting. "'Fool, all lies in a passion of patience, my lord's rule.'
"'What's that from?' asked Jane.
"'Taliesin Throcklogers.'
"'Mr. McPhee probably approves of no poets except Burns.'
"'Burns!' said McPhee with profound contempt, "'opening the drawer of his table with great energy "'and producing a formidable sheaf of papers. "'If you're going to the garden, don't let me delay your ladies.'
"'He's been telling you?'
said Camilla, "'as the two girls went together down the passage. "'Moved by a kind of impulse which was rare to her experience, "'Jane seized her friend's hand as she answered, "'Yes.' Both were filled with some passion, but what passion they did not know. They came to the front door, and as they opened it, a sight met their eyes which, though natural, seemed at the moment apocalyptic. All day the wind had been rising, and they found themselves looking out on a sky swept almost clean. The air was intensely cold, the stars severe and bright. High above the last rags of scurrying clouds hung the moon in all her wildness. Not the voluptuous moon of a thousand southern love songs, but the huntress, the untamable virgin, the spearhead of madness. If that cold satellite had just then joined our planet for the first time, it could hardly have looked more like an omen. The wildness crept into Jane's blood.
"'That Mr. McPhee,' said Jane, as they walked steeply uphill to the very summit of the garden. "'I know,' said Camilla, and then, "'You believed it?'
"'Of course.'
"'How does Mr. McPhee explain the director's age?'
"'You mean his looking, or being, so young, if you call it young?'
"'Yes. That is what people are like who come back from the stars, or at least from Perelandra. Paradise is still going on there. Make him tell you about it sometime. He will never grow a year or a month older again.'
"'Will he die?'
"'He will be taken away, I believe, back into deep heaven. It has happened to one or two people, perhaps about six, since the world began.'
"'Camilla?'
"'Yes?'
What is he?
He's a man, my dear, and he is the Pendragon of Logers. This house, all of us here, and Mr. Bultitude and Pinch, are all that's left of the Logers. All the rest has become merely Britain. Go on, let's go right to the top. How it's blowing. They might come to him tonight.
4. That evening Jane washed up under the attentive eye of Baron Corvo, the jackdaw, while the others held counsel in the blue room. "'Well,' said Ransom, as Grace Ironwood concluded reading from her notes, "'that is the dream, and everything in it seems to be objective.'
"'Objective?' said Dimble. "'I don't understand, sir. You don't mean they could really have a thing like that?'
"'What do you think, McPhee?' asked Ransom.
"'Oh, aye, it's possible,' said McPhee. "'You see, it's an old experiment with animals' heads. They do it often in laboratories.' You cut off a cat's head, maybe, and throw the body away. You can keep the head going a bit if you supply it with blood at the right pressure.
Oh, fancy, said Ivy Maggs.
Do you mean keep it alive? Said Dimble. Alive is an ambiguous word. You can keep all the functions. It's what would be popularly called alive. But a human head and consciousness, I don't know what would happen if you tried that.
It has been tried, said Miss Ironwood. A German tried it before the First War, with the head of a criminal.
"'Is that a fact?' said McPhee, with great interest. "'And do you know what result he got?'
"'It failed. The head simply decayed in the ordinary way.'
"'I've had enough of this, I have,' said Ivy Maggs, rising and abruptly leaving the room. "'Then this filthy abomination,' said Dr. Dimble, "'is real, not only a dream.' His face was white, and his expression strained. His wife's face, on the other hand, showed nothing more than that controlled distaste with which a lady of the old school listens to any disgusting detail when its mention becomes unavoidable.
"'We have no evidence of that,' said McPhee. "'I'm only stating facts. What the girl has dreamed is possible.'
"'And what about this turban business?' said Denniston, "'this sort of swelling on top of the head.'
"'You see what it might be,' said the director.
"'I'm not sure that I do, sir,' said Dimble.
"'Supposing the dream to be veridical,' said McPhee, "'you can guess what it would be. Once they'd got it kept alive, the first thing that would occur to boys like them would be to increase its brain. They'd try all sorts of stimulants. And then maybe they'd ease open the skull cap and just, well, just let it boil over, as you might say. That's the idea, I don't doubt. A cerebral hypertrophy, artificially induced to support a superhuman power of ideation.
Is it at all probable, said the director, that a hypertrophy like that would increase thinking power?
That seems to me the weak point, said Miss Ironwood. I should have thought it was just as likely to produce lunacy, or nothing at all. But it might have the opposite effect.
There was a thoughtful silence.
Then what we are up against, said Dimble, is a criminal's brain swollen to superhuman proportions and experiencing a mode of consciousness which we can't imagine, but which is presumably a consciousness of agony and hatred.
It's not certain, said Miss Ironwood, that there would be very much actual pain. Some from the neck, perhaps, at first.
What concerns us much more immediately, said McPhee, is to determine what conclusions we can draw from these carryings on with Alcassan's head, and what practical steps should be taken on our part, always and simply as a working hypothesis, assuming the dream to be veridical.
"It tells us one thing straight away," said Deniston.
"What's that?" asked McPhee.
"That the enemy movement is international. To get that head, they must have been hand in glove with at least one foreign police force."
McPhee rubbed his hands. "Man," he said, "you have the makings of a logical thinker. But the deduction's not all that certain. Bribery might account for it without actual consolidation."
"It tells us something in the long run even more important," said the director. "It means that if this technique is really successful, the Bellbury people have, for all practical purposes, discovered a way of making themselves immortal."
There was a moment's silence, and then he continued, "It is the beginning of what is really a new species, the chosen heads who never die. They will call it the next step in evolution, and henceforward all the creatures that you and I call human are mere candidates for admission to the new species, or else its slaves. Perhaps its food."
"The emergence of the bodiless men," said Dimble.
"Very likely, very likely," said McPhee, extending his snuff-box to the last speaker. It was refused, and he took a very deliberate pinch before proceeding.
"But there's no good at all applying the forces of rhetoric to make ourselves skeery, or daffing our own heads off our shoulders because some other fellows have had the shoulders taken from under their heads. I'll back the director's head, and yours, Dr. Dimble, and my own, against this lad's, whether the brains is boiling out of it or no, provided we use them. I should be glad to hear what practical measures on our side are suggested."
With these words he tapped his knuckles gently on his knee and stared hard at the director.
"It is," said McPhee, "a question I have ventured to propound before."
A sudden transformation, like the leaping up of a flame in embers, passed over Grace Ironwood's face.
"Can the director not be trusted to produce his own plan in his own time, Mr. McPhee?" she said fiercely.
"By the same token, doctor," said he, "can the director's counsel not be trusted to hear his plan?"
"What do you mean, McPhee?" asked Dimble.
"Mr. Director," said McPhee, "you'll excuse me for speaking frankly. Your enemies have provided themselves with this head. They have taken possession of Edgestow, and they're in a fair way to suspend the laws of England. And still you tell us it is not time to move. If you had taken my advice 6 months ago, we would have had an organization all over this island by now, and maybe a party in the House of Commons.
I know well what you'll say, that those are not the right methods, and maybe no. But if you can neither take our advice nor give us anything to do, what are we all sitting here for? Have you seriously considered sending us away and getting some other colleagues that you can work with?"
"Dissolve the company, do you mean?" said Dimble.
"Aye, I do," said McPhee.
The director looked up with a smile. "But," he said, "I have no power to dissolve it."
"In that case," said McPhee, "I must ask what authority you had to bring it together."
"I never brought it together," said the director. Then, after glancing round the company, he added, "There is some strange misunderstanding here. Were you all under the impression I had selected you?"
"Were you?" he repeated, when no one answered.
"Well," said Dimble, "as regards myself, I fully realise that the thing has come about more or less unconsciously, even accidentally. There was no moment at which you asked me to join a definite movement, or anything of that kind.
That is why I have always regarded myself as a sort of camp follower. I had assumed that the others were in a more regular position. "You know why Camilla and I are here, sir," said Denniston. "We certainly didn't intend or foresee how we were going to be employed." Grace Ironwood looked up with a set expression on her face, which had grown rather pale. "Do you wish—" she began. The director laid his hand on her arm. "No," he said. "No, there is no need for all these stories to be told." McPhee's stern features relaxed into a broad grin. "I see what you're driving at," he said. "We've all been playing blind man's buff, I doubt. But I'll take leave to observe, Dr. Ransom, that you carry things a wee bit high. I don't just remember how you came to be called director, but from that title and from one or two other indications, a man would have thought you behaved more like the leader of an organization than the host at a house party." "I am the director," said Ransom, smiling. "Do you think I would claim the authority I do if the relation between us depended either on your choice or mine? You never chose me. I never chose you. Even the great Oyeresu, whom I serve, never chose me. I came into their worlds by what seemed at first a chance, as you came to me, as the very animals in this house first came to it. You and I have not started or devised this. It has descended on us, sucked us into itself, if you like. It is, no doubt, an organization, but we are not the organizers. And that is why I have no authority to give any one of you permission to leave my household." For a time there was complete silence in the blue room, except for the crackling of the fire. "If there is nothing more to discuss," said Grace Ironwood presently, "perhaps we had better leave the director to rest." McPhee rose and dusted some snuff off the baggy knees of his trousers, thus preparing a wholly novel adventure for the mice when they next came out in obedience to the director's whistle. "I have no notion," he said, "of leaving this house if anyone wishes me to stay. But as regards the general hypothesis on which the director appears to be acting, and the very peculiar authority he claims, I absolutely reserve my judgment. You know well, Mr. Director, in what sense I have, and in what sense I have not, complete confidence in yourself." The director laughed. "Heaven forbid," he said, "that I should claim to know what goes on in the two halves of your head, McPhee, much less how you connect them. But I know, what matters much more, the kind of confidence I have in you. But won't you sit down? There is much more to be said." McPhee resumed his chair. Grace Ironwood, who had been sitting bolt upright in hers, relaxed, and the director spoke. "We have learned tonight," he said, "if not what the real power behind our enemies is doing, at least the form in which it is embodied at Belbury. We therefore know something about one of the two attacks which are about to be made on our race. But I'm thinking of the other."
"Yes," said Camilla earnestly, "the other."
"Meaning by that?" asked McPhee. "Meaning," said Ransom, "whatever is under Bragdon Wood." "You're still thinking about that," said the Ulsterman. A moment of silence ensued. "I am thinking of almost nothing else," said the director. "We knew already that the enemy wanted the wood. Some of us guessed why. Now Jane has seen, or rather felt, in a vision, what it is they are looking for in Bragdon. It may be the greater danger of the two. But what is certain is that the greatest danger of all is the junction of the enemy's forces. He is staking everything on that. When the new power from Belbury joins up with the old power under Bragdon Wood, Logres, indeed man, will be almost surrounded. For us, everything turns on preventing that junction. That is the point at which we must be ready both to kill and die. But we cannot strike yet. We cannot get into Bragdon and start excavating for ourselves. There must be a moment when they find him, it. I have no doubt we shall be told in one way or another. Till then we must wait."
"I don't believe a word of all that other story," said McPhee.
"I thought," said Miss Ironwood, "we weren't to use words like believe. I thought we were only to state facts and exhibit implications."
"If you two quarrel much more," said the director, "I think I'll make you marry one another."
5. At the beginning, the grand mystery for the company had been why the enemy wanted Bragdon Wood. The land was unsuitable and could be made fit to bear a building on the scale they proposed only by the costliest preliminary work, and Edgestow itself was not an obviously convenient place. By intense study and collaboration with Dr. Dimble, and despite the continued scepticism of McPhee, the director had at last come to a certain conclusion. Dimble and he and the Denistons shared between them a knowledge of Arthurian Britain which Orthodox scholarship will probably not reach for some centuries. They knew that Edgestow lay in what had been the very heart of ancient Logres, that the village of Cure Hardy preserved the name of Ozanna Le Coeur Hardy, and that a historical Merlin had once worked in what was now Bragdon Wood. What exactly he had done there they did not know, but they had all, by various routes, come too far either to consider his art mere legend and imposture, or to equate it exactly with what the Renaissance called magic. Dimble even maintained that a good critic, by his sensibility alone, could detect the difference between the traces which the two things had left on literature. What common measure is there, he would ask, between ceremonial occultists like Faustus and Prospero and Archimago, with their midnight studies, their forbidden books, their attendant fiends or elementals, and a figure like Merlin, who seems to produce his results simply by being Merlin? And Ransom agreed. He thought that Merlin's art was the last survival of something older and different, something brought to Western Europe after the fall of Numenor, and going back to an era in which the general relations of mind and matter on this planet had been other than those we know. It had probably differed from Renaissance magic profoundly. It had possibly, though this was doubtful, been less guilty. It had certainly been more effective, for Paracelsus and Agrippa and the rest had achieved little or nothing. Bacon himself, no enemy to magic except on this account, reported that the magicians attained not to greatness and certainty of works. The whole Renaissance outburst of forbidden arts had, it seemed, been a method of losing one's soul on singularly unfavourable terms. But the older art had been a different proposition. But if the only possible attraction of Bragdon lay in its association with the last vestiges of Atlantean magic, this told the company something else. It told them that the NICE, at its core, was not concerned solely with modern or materialistic forms of power. It told the director, in fact, that there was Eldilic energy and Eldilic knowledge behind it. It was, of course, another question whether its human members knew of the dark powers who were their real organizers. And in the long run, this question was not, perhaps, important. As Ransom himself had said more than once, whether they know it or whether they don't, much the same sort of things are going to happen. It's not a question of how the Belbury people are going to act. The Dark Eldils will see to that. But of how they will think about their actions. They'll go to Bragdon. It remains to be seen whether any of them will know the real reason why they're going there, or whether they'll all fudge up some theory of soils or air or etheric tensions to explain it. Up to a certain point, the director had supposed that the powers for which the enemy hankered were resident in the mere site at Bragdon, for there is an old and widespread belief that locality itself is of importance in such matters. But from Jane's dream of the cold sleeper he had learned better. It was something much more definite, something located under the soil of Bragdon Wood, something to be discovered by digging. It was, in fact, the body of Merlin. What the Eldils had told him about the possibility of such discovery he had received, while they were with him, almost without wonder. It was no wonder to them. In their eyes, the normal Tellurian modes of being, engendering and birth and death and decay, which are to use the framework of thought, were no less wonderful than the countless other patterns of being which were continually present to their unsleeping minds. To those high creatures whose activity builds what we call nature, nothing is natural. From their station, the essential arbitrariness, so to call it, of every actual creation is ceaselessly visible. For them there are no basic assumptions. All springs with the wilful beauty of a jest or a tune from that miraculous moment of self-limitation wherein the infinite, rejecting a myriad of possibilities, throws out of himself the positive and elected invention. That a body should lie uncorrupted for 1500 years did not seem strange to them. They knew worlds where there was no corruption at all. That its individual life should remain latent in it all that time was to them no more strange. They had seen innumerable different modes in which soul and matter could be combined and separated, separated without loss of reciprocal influence, combined without true incarnation, fused so utterly as to be a third thing, or periodically brought together in a union as short and as momentous as the nuptial embrace. It was not as a marvel in natural philosophy, but as an information in time of war that they brought the director their tidings. Merlin had not died. His life had been hidden, sidetracked, moved out of our one-dimension time for 15 centuries. But under certain conditions, it would return to his body. They had not told him this till recently because they had not known it. One of Ransom's greatest difficulties in disputing with McPhee, who consistently professed to disbelieve the very existence of the Eldils, was that McPhee made the common but curious assumption that if there are creatures wiser and stronger than man, they must be forthwith omniscient and omnipotent. In vain did Ransom endeavour to explain the truth. Doubtless the great beings who now so often came to him had power sufficient to sweep Belbury from the face of England and England from the face of the globe, perhaps to blot the globe itself out of existence. But no power of that kind would be used. Nor had they any direct vision into the minds of men. It was in a different place, and approaching their knowledge from the other side, that they had discovered the state of Merlin. Not from inspection of the thing that slept under Bragdon Wood, but from observing a certain unique configuration in that place where those things remain that are taken off time's main road, behind the invisible hedges, into the unimaginable fields. Not all the times that are outside the present are therefore past or future. It was this that kept the director wakeful, with knitted brow, in the small cold hours of that morning when the others had left him. There was no doubt in his mind now that the enemy had brought Bragdon to find Merlin, and if they found him, they would reawake him. The old druid would inevitably cast his lot with the new planners. What could prevent his doing so? A junction would be effected between two kinds of power, which between them would determine the fate of our planet. Doubtless that had been the will of the Dark Eldils for centuries. The physical sciences, good and innocent in themselves, had already, even in Ransom's own time, begun to be warped, had been subtly manoeuvred in a certain direction. Despair of objective truth had been increasingly insinuated into the scientists. Indifference to it and a concentration upon mere power had been the result. Babble about the élan vital and flirtations with panpsychism were bidding fair to restore the anima mundi of the magicians. Dreams of the far future destiny of man were dragging up from its shallow and unquiet grave the old dream of man as God. The very experiences of the dissecting room and the pathological laboratory were breeding a conviction that the stifling of all deep-set repugnances was the first essential for progress. And now, all this had reached the stage at which its dark contrivers thought they could safely begin to bend it back, so that it would meet that other and earlier kind of power. Indeed, they were choosing the first moment at which this could have been done. You could not have done it with 19th-century scientists. Their firm, objective materialism would have excluded it from their minds. And even if they could have been made to believe, their inherited morality would have kept them from touching dirt. McPhee was a survivor from that tradition. It was different now. Perhaps few or none of the people at Belbury knew what was happening. But once it happened, they would be like straw in fire. What should they find incredible, since they believed no longer in a rational universe? What should they regard as too obscene, since they held that all morality was a mere subjective byproduct of the physical and economic situations of men? The time was ripe. From the point of view which is accepted in hell, the whole history of our earth had led up to this moment. There was now, at last, a real chance for fallen man to shake off that limitation of his powers which mercy had imposed upon him as a protection from the full results of his fall. If this succeeded, hell would at last be incarnate. Bad men, while still in the body, still crawling on this little globe, would enter that state which, heretofore, they had entered only after death, would have the diuturnity and power of evil spirits. Nature, all over the globe of Tellus, would become their slave. And of that dominion no end, before the end of time itself, could be certainly foreseen.